In the Army alone, what began as a small pilot project Congress first created in 2012 has since grown to 133 separate programs, all designed to match the skills soldiers need to do their jobs in the military with the certifications the rest of the world expects to see from civilian employees doing similar work. As of last October, all four of the defense services now have their own web portals up and running, letting service members match their military skills with the credentials they'll need to perform similar jobs once they leave the military. And each of them now pay the costs of taking the exams run by outside certification bodies. For service members' post-civilian careers, having military-acquired skills that aren't recognized by the civilian sector has served as a significant impediment to employment for transitioning veterans. Conversely, having the certifications makes a huge difference, says Colonel Reed Hudgens, the Director for Credentialing, Certification, and Licensing at the Army's Training and Doctrine Command.
What really excited us was we began to do some mapping. That mapping was through Department of Labor Statistics. Just to throw one out there that was astounding to us, a maritime credential. A maritime credential that we could get through having an Army mariner go through school, achieve that credential, and for less than $300 at the end of their career, achieve a National Maritime Center credential. It's a $20,000 difference in starting salary for that NCO.
But Hudgens says the military's new enthusiasm for civilian credentialing isn't based entirely on the benefits it brings to members who are departing service. Increasingly, they've come to see it as a relatively low-cost method to import workforce development best practices from the private sector and to maintain military readiness.
Where does that enable us? It enables us to professionalize the force. Industry best practices really make up credentials. Industry keeps the credential alive, viable. It keeps that credential fresh and new. That's R&D money we don't have to spend. That's new education that comes in on an annual basis that we can use, soldiers can gain access to, and keeps that force professionalized, lifelong learning, and it keeps that individual interested as well, is what we found. And finally, it's applicable to the total force. Without the National Guard, without the reserves, we can't do what it is we do. A little number figure for you. Inside the sustainment community, your transporters, your cooks, your mechanics, everything that makes things move, 78% of that force is National Guard and Reserve. How do you keep somebody Guard and Reserve? Well, generally, you keep them Guard and Reserve when they have a job in the civilian world as well. So having something that applies as a credential to the total force allows me to have a job on the outside that might be commensurate with something that I do for the military, keeps that total force, keeps that Army family together.
Also, over the past 2 years, the military services have created venues amongst themselves to share best practices for civilian credentialing, including a joint council for their web portals, each called Credentialing Opportunities Online, or COOL. The Pentagon expects to roll out its own joint portal within the next several months to link those portals together and expand its outreach to private employers and credentialing bodies. The Navy is the furthest ahead. It's had an active civilian credentialing program since 2006. It's paid for 120,000 civilian credentials for its sailors since then, and it's the only service so far that's managed to map each one of its job specialties to private sector certification programs. Keith Boring is the Navy's credential program manager.
39% of the credentials we've funded were for sailors that are on the pointy end of that spear, that are on board ships or deployed overseas. So it's not a program for those sailors that are just lucky enough to be stationed shore, stateside on shore. These are credentials that they can get on board ships, overseas, forward operating bases as well. So as the Navy grows its program, we're not done growing. We don't want to be in a static point. That's why we love being able to partner with the other services, because they're bringing up ideas like, ooh, we didn't think of that. We're going to immediately implement that.
For instance, even though the Air Force was a relative latecomer to the civilian credentialing effort, one of its first successes was to convince the Federal Aviation Administration to recognize the skills military aircraft maintainers learn during their own arduous training as good or better than FAA's own requirements to certify commercial mechanics. J.R. Breeding is an associate dean for the Community College of the Air Force and a former aircraft maintainer.
Just my personal experience, working with the FAA, it was just a long and cumbersome process just to receive eligibility to take the exams, and then the exams itself is another story. So between meeting eligibility and preparing for the exams, there's got to be a better way. It just so happened that the stars aligned. I was able to work with headquarters FAA, the career field managers up at the Pentagon, to get the FAA to recognize what the Air Force training and practical experiences, what they mean and how they equate to this event industry. We developed a very good working relationship with the FAA, and then we decided to build a program, and we decided to bring in other services. Now we have a joint service program that is recognized by headquarters FAA, so our military service members can receive their A&P certification. And it's another program that's also recognized by the airline industry. So it's a win-win solution for not just the military, but also for the civilian sector as well.
While there are some cases like that, where military skills map directly to civilian career certifications, they tend to be the exception and not the rule. So the military services have adopted an approach that says if 80% of their training requirements are similar to industry requirements, a service member should be offered the chance to get the civilian credential on the military's dime. But Lisa Lutz, a private consultant who's studied the issue for decades, including for DOD's own projects, says certification bodies are changing their practices too, trying to account for the fact that while a military member might not have all of the skills a civilian employer might want, they also don't need to repeat the portions of the training they've already done while in uniform.
We're seeing national certification agencies who are developing specific requirements just for the military. The state licensing agencies and the various state organizations have become engaged. That's huge. I don't think I ever thought we would crack the state licensing nut, so to speak. So that's wonderful.
But there are still some significant challenges when it comes to the state boards and commissions that regulate everything from commercial driver's licenses to barber shops. Thomas Perez, the Secretary of Labor, says his department, DOD, and Congress have made major inroads toward cutting out certification barriers for departing military members, but state bureaucracy remains a major challenge.
Credentialing is a state-by-state issue, so you've got to tackle this one state at a time, and that's exactly what we have been doing. And again, we found a lot of receptivity among states. The challenge that a number of states have, and having worked at a state, is that then there are individual accrediting bodies for every occupation. So there's a nursing board, there's a board for other occupations, and so you have to sometimes tackle it occupation by occupation, and that's time consuming. We're seeing progress. We're doing our level best to make sure that it, regardless of what state you work in, if you're that EMT who was on, working in a war zone in Iraq, you've demonstrated the competencies of the job, then you ought to be able to get licensed much faster. And that's our goal.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.